Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
The BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
The leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda have signed a peace deal aimed at ending a long-running conflict in eastern Congo. We get the details from the Rwandan foreign minister.
The Trump administration led the talks between the two sides, and Donald Trump said it was time to begin healing old wounds.
And the Eurovision Song Contest has been thrown into turmoil after four countries said they would boycott next year's event.
Yeah, Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be excluded from the contest because of the war in Gaza. We'll get more on this story after a bulletin of the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has been given a 21-gun salute ahead of talks with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The Trump administration is expected to be watching the meeting closely. Arunadeh Mukherjee is in Delhi.
They're going to be focusing largely on trade, on strategic cooperation, on India's purchase of Russian crude oil, something that Russia would be very keen that India continues to do. Also trying to ensure that India continues to buy critical defense equipment from Russia. It is important to understand that all of this is happening in the context of harsh U.S. tariffs of nearly 50% that continue to be on India, some of the highest in the world, really, which is why it is going to be a bit of a balancing act for Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs, killing four men in the Eastern Pacific. The military issued a statement alongside a video of the attack. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
In a statement on the social media platform X, the US military said the latest attack occurred after intelligence confirmed that the vessel was carrying illegal narcotics along a known narco-trafficking route. Alongside video of the attack, the statement says the strike was carried out at the direction of the US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth. Earlier, lawmakers were shown video of a September attack involving two strikes on a boat that killed two stranded sailors. Democratic Senator Jack Reed said he was deeply disturbed by what he'd seen and called for the video to be released to the public.
Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia say they will boycott next year's Eurovision Song Contest in protest at Israel's participation. They announced their decision after the European Broadcasting Union decided not to hold a vote on whether Israel should be excluded over its military action in Gaza. Here's our music correspondent, Mark Savage.
This is the biggest crisis in Eurovision's 70-year history, with little sign that the differences over Israel's role can be resolved. Germany welcomed the decision not to disqualify the country, and the BBC said it supported the collective decision. But there is still a possibility that more countries could pull out, including Belgium and Iceland. The Spanish broadcaster, RTVE, has been particularly outspoken, saying it has lost faith in Eurovision's organisers.
A university in Hong Kong has ordered its students' union to shut down after a message was posted on campus expressing condolences and urging justice for the victims of the huge fire last week that killed nearly 160 people. In a letter shared online, the Hong Kong Baptist University cited reasons for the ban, including lack of representation and poor financial management. World News from the BBC. Pakistan's powerful army commander has officially taken over as the country's first chief of defence forces, consolidating control across all military branches. Field Marshal Asim Munir became army chief 3 years ago. Parliament granted him legal immunity last month. Critics see his ascendancy as a power grab. Donald Trump has hired a new architect for the construction of the $300 million White House ballroom after reported disagreements with the project's original designer. Local media say James McCreary had expressed concern about the size of the project and the ballroom overshadowing the main White House building. A BBC investigation has found more than 250 LGBT people were subjected to electric shock aversion therapy in Britain's health service in the 1960s and 70s, many more than previously thought. At the time, some medical staff in Britain and elsewhere claimed the practice could change people's sexuality or gender identity. Hayley Hassell reports.
Survivors of aversion therapy describe being strapped to chairs and given painful electric shocks to their arms and legs. Those who were given the treatment as teenagers describe lifelong trauma, including physical pain, PTSD and depression. Many were coerced into agreeing to it, told they'd be expelled from school or would lose their jobs if they refused. The Equalities Minister, Olivia Bailey, condemned the practice as utterly appalling, and the BBC understands the government will now investigate the historical use of aversion therapy in the NHS.
Police in New Zealand say they have recovered a diamond-studded locket which was swallowed by a suspected thief almost a week ago. Officials say the Fabergé egg locket, which is valued at around $20,000, was recovered naturally and that medical intervention was not required. BBC News.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from Nairobi with me, Anne Soy, and from London with Rob Young.
Yeah, you've joined, Anne, the Newsday team, in a week when there's an awful lot of news happening in your part of the world. We have the signing of the DR Congo and Rwanda peace deal, one of our main talking points today as well.
That's right, and our listeners have been sending their thoughts. Here's one from Clinton Mogaka Ongeri in Mombasa. He says that the signing of the peace agreement between Rwanda and the DRC was necessary. It marks the beginning of a new chapter, but the absence of key armed groups like M23 raises doubts whether the accord alone can end violence.
Amara Alpha listening in Kenema in Sierra Leone is more optimistic than that. He says it is a great day. Therefore, the signing of the peace deal is a clear indication, he says, that more than 30 years of conflict in the DRC will now come to an end. We will assess whether that is indeed too optimistic over the next 20 minutes or so. More thoughts welcome, of course, on that story. Do send your texts or WhatsApps to +44 77 86 20 50 85.
Also in this half hour, we'll cross to Singapore, as we always do. Nick Marsh will tell us why Meta, the Facebook owner, may be giving up on its famous metaverse.
So the leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda have signed a peace deal aimed at ending the long-running conflict in a region in the east of DR Congo. They were at a summit hosted by the US President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. Now, the mineral-rich east of the DRC has been dogged by conflict for more than 30 years since the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Numerous armed groups have competed with the central authorities for power and control of the potential fortune in this vast nation. President Trump said it was a great day for Africa and the world.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda have agreed to more closely integrate their economies with each other rather than fighting, and they'll be doing that. And these two gentlemen are very smart, and I think they liked each other a lot. They've spent a lot of time killing each other, and now they're going to spend a lot of time hugging, holding hands, and taking advantage of the United States of America economically like every other country does. So they're going to do very well.
Well, we didn't see any hugging or holding of hands between the two leaders who were there. In fact, we didn't even see them shake hands. Earlier on, the Democratic Republic of the Congo Foreign Minister, Therese Kayikwamba-Wagner, spoke to the BBC.
I think there's a lot of optimism, but there's also a lot of expectations. And I think we want to focus on the expectations that are very legitimate. After 30 years of war, I think it is completely legitimate and expected to have all sides, all signatories have high expectations towards this agreement that was signed today. Optimism is something that we will have to build with time, with measures that will bring back trust between the different stakeholders. But I want to say that we are determined. I want to say that today was a clear illustration of the commitment of all stakeholders. And I think this is a step-by-step process. And with time, with commitment, and with tangible results, we will be moving closer to optimism.
Well, the signing comes despite fighting continuing between Congolese government forces and the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. Now, Anne, new presenter here on Newsday. Before you started this job on Monday, you were the BBC's Deputy Africa Editor. So you've covered this conflict a lot over the years. Just explain how we got to this point.
It's a complicated security outlook in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, with multiple conflicts going on in this vast region, but also very rich region, with mineral wealth estimated to be worth about $25 trillion, and that is thought to be part of the problem. There are dozens of armed groups operating them there, and one of them is M23 rebels, who have taken over huge swathes of territory earlier this year. They now control the largest city in the region, and this particular conflict involves those rebels. They have been fighting against another group of rebels called the FDLR, which is a French acronym for the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, a group that Rwanda has always been against because some of its members are former genocidaires in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. And during that time, many of them fled into Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, and that fueled suspicion and conflicts over the last three decades.
And you mentioned those two of many militia groups in that part of DR Congo. They were not at these peace talks. They have not signed these peace agreements. And when you look at a map of Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo is huge. Rwanda, in comparison, is tiny. Yet it seems to be Rwanda, which, and its rebels that it is backing, the M23, which have had the military upper hand here.
That's right. The DRC is estimated to be roughly the size of the whole of Western Europe. And so you can imagine how vast it is. And then Rwanda is a tiny country in Eastern Africa. But then it has the military strength. And, you know, after signing this deal now, many people are waiting to see what's going to happen. There's a lot of skepticism, it has to be said, on the ground, because there have been other deals signed in the past.
And you've been talking to somebody who's been intimately involved in these peace negotiations.
That's right. I spoke to Rwanda's Foreign Minister, Olivier Nduhungirehe, from Washington, D.C.
This is a historical deal. We have signed today the Washington Accords for Peace and Prosperity, which is an agreement that comprises three agreements that we signed. There is the Declaration of Principles of 25th of April, the Peace Agreement of 27th of June, and the Regional Economic Integration Framework that we signed today. So those three agreements, together with any other agreement or arrangement of implementation, will form these Washington Accords for Peace and Prosperity. And we hope that today we have signed with President Trump, this agreement will be implemented.
So what should the people living in the affected region expect to see?
What we need now to achieve is to implement this agreement, and this requires good faith and political will. We have been alerting the world in the past weeks and months about the continued violation of the ceasefire by the DRC government through its fighter jets and attack drones that have been attacking position of the M23, which is in violation of the ceasefire, but also
Minister,
attacking the Banyamulenge communities, which is more worrying because those communities are being targeted for who they are in a context of rise of hate speech.
In the last 24 hours and more, we have seen some renewed fighting in South Kivu, and both sides, both M23 rebels who claim to be supported by your government and the Congolese army, are trading blame. M23 is accused of trying to attack villages near Uvira, and you blame the Congolese army in this. But given that this is happening just around the time of the signing of these deals, doesn't it undermine the credibility of the agreements that you're entering from day one?
Yes, but the issue is not the last 24 hours. The issue is the last 24 weeks, even more, with those fighter jets and the attack drones that have been attacking positions of the M23 and the Banyamulenge communities in violation of the ceasefire, not to mention the Burundian forces that are on the ground in South Kivu surrounding villages of the Banyamulenge. So that, I think, did not interest the media. So this was a clear violation of the ceasefire. If this triggers a reaction of the forces on the ground, it's something that needs to be seen as a continued violation by the DRC government for the past weeks and months.
The Congolese army says that it was responding to attacks on the ground by M23. But, you know, it just takes people back
this
to
is what
has
say.
Been happening over years, just trading blame between the two sides. So does the deals that you have signed make any difference?
No, the deals, for any deal in any case, need to be implemented. And for to implement the peace deal or any peace deal, we need good faith and political will. So how come that we signed a peace agreement on 27th of June, so which 5 months ago, then after that, we have every day air bombardments by the government through fighter jets and attack drones. This is what should be worry the world, worry the region, but because it's as if what the government of DRC signed with his right hand, it doesn't believe it, it doesn't feel it with its heart. So it's something that needs to worry the world.
M23, whom you're accused of supporting, have also been staging attacks and gaining ground. But just to move on from that point, part of this deal also is about the withdrawal of Rwandan forces from eastern DRC. When will that happen?
There's nowhere in any deal that state that Rwanda should withdraw its troops, because we don't have troops in eastern DRC.
It is stated as lifting of defensive mechanisms. You have been repeatedly accused of having troops on the ground, including by UN reports.
Yes, but we signed an agreement, the Washington Peace Agreement, that comprises concept of operation for the neutralization of the FDLR genocidal force and the lifting of Rwanda's defensive measures. So now, as we speak, 5 months after the signing of the agreement, we are yet to see the neutralization of those FDLR. So these security aspects have those two components.
The Congolese president has said that they are not going to advance this deal unless you withdraw your troops from eastern Congo. So what does this mean? Does this change anything?
What we need to do is just to implement what we signed. And what we signed is very clear. It has obligations for each side. And the security obligations we have is to neutralize the FDLR, which will allow for the lifting of Rwanda's defensive measures. So this is what something that we should be doing. So the Congolese side cannot say that, talk about Rwandan troops or anything about Rwanda without talking about its part of the deal, which is to neutralize the FDLR that are supported by the DRC government, that are embedded in the DRC army. And this is something that they should be doing before talking about anything else.
Is Rwanda going to cease supporting M23 rebels?
Rwanda doesn't support the M23. The M23 is negotiating with the DRC government in Doha to find a solution to the problem they have. They have actually on 15th of December signed a framework agreement which will settle the problem they have, addressing the root causes, which include the marginalization and persecution of the Congolese Tutsi, the Congolese of Rwandan culture and language. So this is a separate issue that is being dealt with in Doha.
The UN says that the Rwandan army is in de facto control of M23 operations, including training their recruits under the supervision of Rwandan forces and supporting the rebels with high-tech Rwandan weaponry. Do you deny
that? No, this is what they say. They should actually focus on the support that the FDLR is getting from the DRC government. This is the main issue.
Do you deny this report by the UN?
We already denied it, madam.
President Trump says that everybody is going to make a lot of money. What is in it for Rwanda?
Oh, it's an important agreement. The Regional Economic Integration Framework that we signed today provide economic opportunities for both DRC and Rwanda, also with the support of the US, because we have now agreed to make joint investment in energy, for example, hydraulic project, the methane gas that we have in the Lake Kivu, which is between Rwanda and DRC, to co-manage the national parks we have in common, and also to work on a critical minerals value chain between Rwanda and DRC. So those are plenty of opportunities, not to mention infrastructure. This will open a new chapter of a positive narrative or of cooperation between Rwanda and DRC.
Rwanda's Foreign Minister Olivier Nduhungirehe speaking to me a little earlier.
Now, the Eurovision Song Contest, which is watched by more than 150 million people a year, is facing the biggest crisis in its 70-year history. A string of nations, including Spain, the Republic of Ireland and the Netherlands, have announced they'll be boycotting the 2026 event because Israel will be taking part. We can speak now to Dr. Paul Jordan, who is an expert on the Eurovision Song Contest. He's known as Dr. Eurovision due to his PhD on the contest. Welcome to the programme. How damaging would you say this boycott is to the Eurovision Song Contest?
Hi there. Good morning, Rob. I think it's very damaging, actually. I think this is quite a flashpoint, really. It's a bit of a crisis moment. And unfortunately, it's also making, you know, it's the organisers they're making, because they've hoped this issue would go away and they've ignored it. And they've also not really followed their own rules. They allow, you know, certain songs to take part, which are political, even though that's against the rules. They dithered over the Russian situation with Ukraine. And that situation is very different to the current one we're facing with Israel. But they haven't been consistent in terms of, you know, protecting their own rules and, I guess, protecting the song contest. And now, unfortunately, it's become a bit of a political football.
Well, Israel did take part in the 2025 contest and in the 2024 one. So why have these nations decided now to boycott it?
Well, I think that's a good question. I presume it's because the war has gone on and, you know, the horrors that have unfolded in Gaza have, you know, become all too clear. That said, you know, there is a certain amount of, I think, virtue signalling going on here. You know, these countries knew that Israel was going to be part of it. And there are a lot of other countries that have, shall we say, dubious human rights records, you know, Azerbaijan being one, which is said to be a dictatorship. They won the contest and they hosted it. All those countries took part. And all the countries that boycotted also took part in Tel Aviv in 2019. That said, the context is very different now. I understand that. But it's a lot more complicated than just a song contest, because the Netanyahu government have consistently try to shut down the Israeli broadcaster because they hold the government to account and basically, you know, they're public service media. So they're the Israeli ticket to Eurovision. So if Israel was kicked out of the contest, that broadcaster would therefore be shut down, which wouldn't be good for Israeli democracy and civil society. So it's much more complex than just the song contest.
Spain is known as one of the big five. It pumps an awful lot of money into the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union, which funds Eurovision Song Contest. So could there be a financial problem for the 2026 contest?
I think so, because every country pays a participation fee, which is based on their population. So, as you say, Spain is one of the big contributors. You know, we've still got other countries, Germany and the UK, for example, they're part of it and they will also pay a big fee. But if countries withdraw, then, you know, the money's got to be made up somewhere. So it makes the price go up for everyone else. That said, there are a couple of countries returning. I think Moldova, Romania and Bulgaria. But they pay less than Spain for sure. So I think in terms of moving forward, it's going to be interesting to see what happens beyond 2026, because I don't see Israel going anywhere. And so are Ireland and Spain saying they're not taking part in years to come? Who knows? This could be a bit of a watershed moment in Eurovision history.
Well, doesn't this row also throw to the fore, make public what an awful lot of people have long suspected, that the winners and losers of the Eurovision Song Contest is not really to do with the merits of the song or the act. It is largely about politics.
I would say the music still rings true. I think most people are voting for a song. I think certainly there's been political moments, political songs. Ukraine's victory in 2022, I think, was, they had a good song, but I think it was a showing of solidarity. I don't necessarily think it was a political thing. But Eurovision doesn't exist in a bubble, and, you know, politics comes into it like it does with any large-scale international event. You know, the World Cup in Qatar, the Beijing Olympic Games in 2008, you know, Eurovision, for too long, they've always tried to say it's not political. And I think that's to their credit. But at the same time, they need to really get a handle on this and to protect their flagship event. You know, I think it's wonderful that countries have shared that stage that wouldn't necessarily have good relations. Look at Azerbaijan and Armenia. Look at the UK and Ireland in the 70s. Look at Greece and Turkey. So it's got a real place for, I think, public diplomacy. But understand where sometimes, you know, the issues are insurmountable. But to make things even more complicated, you look at Israel's history in the competition, and they had the first trans winner, Dana International. So they've contributed a lot as well. But understand that people are uncomfortable.
Thanks very much indeed. That's Dr. Paul Jordan there, known as Dr. Eurovision. He's an expert on the Eurovision Song Contest.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC with Rob Young in London and Anne Soy in Nairobi. A recap of the latest headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to begin talks with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in the coming hours. And the US military says it has conducted another deadly strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal narcotics as questions mount over the legality of previous attacks.
Let's go to your sport headlines now. Here's Sarah.
In the English Premier League, Manchester United drew 1-1 against West Ham at Old Trafford last night. The Red Devils had led from Diogo Dalot, but a late equaliser from the Hammers means United now sit 8th in the table. After 1,297 consecutive regular season matches with at least 10 points scored, LeBron James finished with only 8 points against the Toronto Raptors. But it was one of the most impressive streaks in NBA history and in sport in general. On the 5th of January 2007, LeBron scored 8 points in Milwaukee, and almost 18 years later, here he is once again held under the 10-point mark. And there is a French sports journalist who's been in prison since May 2024 in Algeria. Christophe Glaise was arrested in Tizi Ouzou, 100 kilometers east of Algiers, where he was working on a story about sports in the region of Kabylia. He was charged and convicted of glorifying terrorism by a local court in June, a ruling that was confirmed by another Algerian court yesterday. Christophe Glaise has been sentenced to 7 years in prison. French President Emmanuel Macron is ramping up diplomatic efforts to secure his release, insisting he wants to see him home as soon as possible.
Sarah will be back in about 25 minutes' time, where we'll be looking ahead to the World Cup draw.
Exactly, we will.
To you then, Sarah. Thank you. Well, let's cross to Singapore now, speak to our business presenter, Nick Marsh, because Meta, the company that owns Facebook, is giving up on the metaverse, this big idea it had a number of years ago, which you're going to have to explain for us all again, Nick.
Yes, with pleasure. Go back to 2021. We were in the thick of the pandemic. People doing virtual meetings. Remember all those quizzes back home as well. Mark Zuckerberg at the time, Facebook founder, of course, he said, I love this. I think this is going to be the future. We're all going to be spending our time in what I'm going to call now the metaverse. And just like that, he rebranded Facebook, the whole company, to Meta. And it's basically an interactive virtual reality space online. You get your little sort of cartoonish avatar. You socialize, you chat, you can even buy stuff. He put lots and lots of money into it. We fast forward to 2025. This bet appears to be winding down. You said he's given up on it. Meta wouldn't say they've given up on it, but it's clear they are cutting the budget. Some reports say up to 30% of their investments are going to be shifted. And where are they going to be shifted to, Rob? To artificial intelligence, of course.
Yes, which is the next big buzzword in the world of tech, isn't it? The metaverse, then, is it going to be consigned to the bin of some of those ideas that might have been big but turned out not to be?
Yeah, it's one of those sort of I told you so moments for a lot of people. It was mocked, wasn't it, when Mark Zuckerberg came out with the idea, when people saw the images. It hasn't done well. I've seen some reports, not confirmed, but some reports in US media that $70 billion has been lost on this project. So you can see why, you know, investors want Zuckerberg to basically cut his losses here. And actually, when the news came out yesterday on the American markets, Meta's share price went up by 7%. So you can see why, you know, he was under so much pressure to move on from that. But like I say, the next big thing is artificial intelligence. Meta wants to look at AI glasses. And as we know, artificial intelligence isn't exactly a short bet either, but it's changing times.
Yeah, you can buy those AI glasses in the shops, I noticed the other day. Thanks very much. That's Nick Marsh at the business desk in Singapore.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media, with support from Progressive Insurance, helping protect small businesses with a variety of coverages like general liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto. Find out more at progressivecommercial.com.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. This week in KQED Arts, arts editor Sarah Hotchkiss reflects on the best art she saw but didn't yet write about this year, plus a guide to the latest crop of holiday movies. That's at kqed.org/arts.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
A peace deal between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda is signed to end the conflict in the region.
We look at what Vladimir Putin really wants from a peace deal in Ukraine and how close he is to getting it.
And we'll speak to the host broadcast of the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest as four nations say they will boycott the event. But first, this news.
BBC News with Govinda Gill. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has been given a 21-gun salute before meeting the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. On the first full day of President Putin's state visit, defence, trade and strategic ties are likely to dominate the talks. The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs, killing four men. Earlier, US military commanders briefed lawmakers on a double strike on a boat in September after questions were raised about the legality of such attacks. There's uncertainty over next year's Eurovision Song Contest after several countries said they would withdraw in protest at Israel's participation. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia announced a boycott after the European Broadcasting Union decided not to hold a vote on whether Israel should be excluded over its military action in Gaza. A Brazilian professor at Harvard University has agreed to leave the US voluntarily after he was arrested for shooting pellets near a synagogue the day before Yom Kippur. Carlos Portugal Gouveia said he was hunting rats. India's largest airline, IndiGo, is cutting back flights from Monday after a week of mass cancellations triggered by a shortage of pilots. Thousands of passengers have been stranded at airports across India after IndiGo cancelled up to 200 flights daily. Donald Trump has hired a new lead architect for the construction of the $300 million White House ballroom. The project's original designer had reportedly expressed concern about the size of the project. Police in New Zealand say they have recovered a diamond-studded locket, which was swallowed by a suspected thief almost a week ago. The man was arrested at a jeweller's minutes after he allegedly ate the Fabergé locket. That's the latest BBC News.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
Well, Anne, you've joined us this week as our new presenter and you're going to be with us each weekday broadcasting from your new studio in Kenya. And so it's great to have your expertise on African stories, particularly as a former senior BBC Africa journalist, as we discuss the peace deal between DR Congo and Rwanda today.
Also great to read so many reactions from our listeners. Here's one from B.W. Bokari from Freetown in Sierra Leone. He says the latest peace deal between the DRC and Rwanda is welcome with cautious optimism following the failures of previous efforts in the past. If the peace holds, it will be great for Africa and the world, despite the individual selfish foreign interests in the mineral-rich region.
Yeah, another one here from Celestine listening in the Gambia, who says the businessman President Trump's peace deal for the conflict in DRC must come with conditions. It's shameful, she says, that Africans can't govern and solve their own problems. Thanks very much indeed for your messages. Do keep them coming to +44 77 86 20 50 85.
And Sarah Minai is in London with you, Rob, and she'll be looking ahead to the draw later for the Men's Football World Cup. It's a bigger competition this time, with more countries taking part, including nine from Africa. And let me ask, as a football fan, I imagine it's one you'll be watching out for with interest, Rob.
Yeah, I'll definitely be watching the draw later on. It's going to be a big event. It's going to last quite a long time. Donald Trump's going to be there, the leaders of Canada and Mexico as well. An awful lot of celebrities also. It's going to be a big entertainment spectacle as well as an important sporting one.
Let's begin this half hour with that top story that we've been covering throughout this morning, the peace deal that is in force this morning after it was signed by the leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda in the United States. The agreement, aimed at ending a long-running conflict in the region, was ratified at a summit in Washington, D.C., hosted by U.S. President Donald Trump.
Great day for Africa, great day for the world, and for these two countries, and they have so much to be proud of, and I want to thank the leaders. I want to thank you very much.
We can now cross to the DRC capital, Kinshasa, and speak to the BBC's Emery Makumeno. Emery, we were just reflecting on how large the DRC is. So this conflict is in the east. Goma to Kinshasa is roughly 2,600 kilometers. But what are people saying about the deal in Kinshasa?
Good morning, Anne. Well, you have a lot of optimism outside the country, but the people I've been talking to here in the capital, Kinshasa in particular, there's a lot of pessimistic views. Many have told me that this will hold only if Rwanda accepts to withdraw its troops out of the eastern DRC, and if they also accept to stop backing up the M23 in eastern DRC. Obviously, people are repeating the corroborated views of the Congolese government, also the views of the UN, but we know that these are allegations Rwanda vehemently denies. And what people have told me, until this is done, if this is not done, they don't see how this will really be an historic moment or something extraordinary that has happened, really.
And that skepticism is not far-fetched, because on the ground the situation remains volatile, with fighting still going on in some areas.
Particularly this week, the fighting has intensified in South Kivu, with the government trying to halt the advance of the M23 rebels, which is hiding somehow the city of Uvira, where the government has relocated its administration. So there have been a lot of skirmishes and little advance from the M23. And both government and the M23 have accused each other of launching the attack, but we haven't been able to independently verify which party has really launched the first the attacks.
Thank you for those updates, Emery Makumeno from Kinshasa. Now, we follow this story. Next, we have one woman's story about how she fled eastern Congo during the latest surge in violence a few months ago. She asked that we do not reveal her name, and I spoke to her from here in Nairobi.
I remember I came back from the US. It was on January 24th. And then Goma, it was a huge tension. The same day I came in Goma, the airport was closed. I was going to settle in Bukavu, where I was born, but then the conflict reached there. During my time in Bukavu, because Goma was taken way before, Bukavu, and during my time, I used to protest against the current, the current government.
That's the M23.
Yes.
They are in charge in Bukavu at the moment. And Goma.
Yes, I used to protest. We used to go to radio broadcast, political broadcast, to talk about all the crimes that are being done in the northern and south Kivu. So, and when the conflict escalated, I was obliged to leave, because I received a message from a direct friend, and he was like, you have to leave because I've seen your name among the red flags name, so you don't stay. Wherever you are, make sure you are not in the northern or south Kivu.
How did you feel?
It was more of shocked, but then it's a price. I knew that was the price behind all the work that I was doing. So I was like, let me just first save my life.
And the airport had been closed, and the rebels were gaining ground territorially.
How did you manage to get out?
I can say this is the most hectic journey that I had. The airport was closed, and then I had to go to Uvira. And if you Google, Uvira actually is one of the highest dangerous zone in northern and south Kivu. And I left the same day M23 was coming to us, like on the 14th of February.
That's when it was entering Bukavu.
Yeah. I left the same day. So we went through 14 checkpoints where your life depended on your look, the language you speak, and the mood of the armed militias. So most of the people I came with didn't make it to Burundi. They died on our way going to Burundi.
What happened to them?
Because crossing to Uvira is not that easy, because it has to depend on the way that you negotiate with the militias, the language you speak, and the mood of the militia. You can even just shoot the way you look and just shoot on you.
They were profiling people based on their looks.
Yes.
So if you look a certain way, they assume you belong to a certain community.
Yeah, I remember my passport had too much stamp, and then they asked me, where are you from? I was like, this is my community. I was born here and I grew up here in South Kivu. I'm just crossing as other people to find my safety. And then there was like, you cannot cross here, because you are a spy. We see, like, you have a U.S. Stamp, you have a U.S. visa, you have this Western visas, you are a spy. And then the armed militias called, he called, I don't know who he was calling, but I heard him saying that we found another spy. I was like, I'm not a spy. And he took me to speak the local language so that they can understand that I'm not from here. So they said, oh, so you can speak the local language here, yes. And I was just trying, just guessing. So thank God I made it through Burundi after waiting like 2 days to cross, because there were people, pregnant women, old people trying to cross. It was not that easy also to cross the border from Uvira to Burundi.
You fled from a refugee camp.
Yes.
So refugees were not allowed to leave the camp?
Nope. And I didn't expect to be hosted in Burundi as a refugee, because Burundi was not even my final destination. My target was like, let me reach Kenya, because Kenya is a bit far away from where I come from. But then when I see that this was like started getting serious, and then I found a way just to run away. I told them that I was going to buy pad. That was the alibi I used to flee.
Sanitary towels.
Yeah, so I fled, and then reaching the city, the Burundian government ordered like to check on all the Congolese coming from the eastern area. I told them that I was going to Nairobi. I was not staying. Then they said, you have like 24 hours to leave our area. As was, we send you back to the refugee camp. That's how I came here. I reached Kenya. I was really mentally affected. Seeing people we came with who died during the journey, and then knowing people, like the people I know being shooted. As I said, 2025 is just a year with so many things, so many. I'm trying just to cope with this.
An activist and resident of Bukavu who fled as M23 were advancing on the city earlier this year. We're keeping her anonymous for her safety.
Now, the Eurovision Song Contest, which is watched by more than 150 million people a year, is facing its biggest crisis in its 70-year history. A string of nations, including Spain, the Republic of Ireland and the Netherlands, have said they will boycott next year's event because Israel will be taking part. Well, the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest will take place in Vienna. It's being hosted by the public broadcaster there, ORF. We can speak to Roland Weissmann, the Director General now of Austria's public broadcaster, ORF. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
How damaging do you think this boycott is for your event?
Oh, I don't think it's damaging. You know, we had a very long but good discussion yesterday in Geneva, where all the DGs met, and we argued and we listened to the arguments of the others, and after that we made a vote, a secret vote. That's democracy, and the majority voted for new, stronger rules by the song contest. And with these new rules, all members of 2025 were allowed to take part as well next year. And therefore, Khan, it's the public broadcaster from Israel. It's not Israel or the government can take part. So some countries said, okay, they won't take part. If Khan takes part, fair enough. We have to accept it. But on the other hand, three new countries already said they will take part. So and we have to wait till the 10th of December, because on the 10th of December, everybody has to agree for the show. So we would like to keep in touch with all the countries, and probably one or another makes another decision, and we will can welcome them in Vienna. In
so you're May expecting 2020. More nations to join this boycott?
No, not no. I think less. No.
Well, you're hoping to persuade what Ireland or the Netherlands or Spain or whoever else back in, are you?
No, you know, we talked yesterday. We had a very good talk, a very good discussion. Yeah, with different point of views, of course. But we will keep on the discussion, and probably we have to wait till the 10th of December. So three or four countries left, probably. Yeah, but there are three other countries who didn't join the song contest for over 5-10 years in the past, and now they will come to Vienna next year. It's Bulgaria, Romania, and Moldova.
Right. Moldova replacing Spain. I mean, it's not quite part of the Eurovision firmament, though, is it, Moldova, in the way that Spain is, one of the big nations, one of the biggest financial contributors also?
No, I know. Of course, I mean, you have to accept that there is a discussion, of course, but my point of view is that it's just broadcasters, public broadcasters take part, not countries. It's not the government of Israel, or it's the public broadcaster Khan, and he will join with a actor, and it's not politics, although politics was brought into song contest, of course.
Well, let me give you some words from some of those fellow public broadcasters. The Dutch broadcaster Avrotros said that participation under the current circumstances is incompatible with the public values that are essential to us. Ireland's RTE said that Ireland's participation remains unconscionable given the appalling loss of lives in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there, which continues to put the lives of so many civilians at risk. Are you saying that these broadcasters are wrong to take a position?
No, it's in a democracy, you know, they are right if they do it like this. Yeah. I went to Israel 2 months ago and I met some representatives of Khan. I know Khan is an independent public broadcaster, and he's, you can say, in opposite to Netanyahu and his government. Yeah, they are not so, and therefore it's important that Khan is in Israel, because it takes an important part for democracy in Israel, because they are independent public broadcaster. And on the other hand, it's about public broadcasters and not about Netanyahu or his government.
Right, so do you agree then with the chief executive of that Israeli broadcaster Khan, who liken the effort to exclude Israel to a form of cultural boycott?
You know, we discussed yesterday for over 2 hours with all the DGs in a very respectful way. Of course, there were different point of views, as you said, yeah. But democracy is important, that you argue, you have different point of views, and then you make a decision. And the majority said, okay, new rules, new stronger rules for the song contest, which includes everybody can take part, also Khan. And if there wouldn't have been a majority for Khan, I would have accepted as well, because that's what democracy is about.
Now, the head of the Spanish broadcaster RTVE said what happened in the EBU assembly, where this vote took place, confirms that Eurovision is not a song contest, but a festival dominated by geopolitical interests. That's right, isn't it? Because a lot of people have long suspected it's not just about the merits of the song. It is also about which nations other nations like and which ones they don't.
Yeah, it was brought in the discussion yesterday, of course, but it's our duty to rethink the song contest. Next year it has its 70th birthday, yeah, and it was built 10 years after World War II, united by music, and that's what it's all about. It's a difficult situation all over the world with crisis, wars, and now it's our duty to keep in contact, to listen to each other, to argue, but then find democratic ways to deal with it.
Okay, united by music. We're not so united at the moment. Thanks very much indeed, Roland Weissman there, Director General of Austria's public broadcaster, ORF.
And from Eurovision to sport now, and it's a big day for football fans around the world. But not everyone is happy. Here's Callista Scully-Bunke in Southeast Nigeria, who says it's a bit of an irony that Curaçao, amongst the smallest countries in the world, will be in the World Cup, but Nigeria, the most populous African country with much of the continent's best players, will not be there. He's not very happy, Sarah.
Indeed, a lot of big football nations, or should I say soccer nations.
You may not.
We'll stick with football. We'll be missing the competition, and Nigeria is one of them, Cameroon as well, Chile, Serbia. And on the other hand, two nations will be making their debut in next year's competition. One of our listeners mentioned Curaçao. The other one is Cap Verde. So who will they face in the group stage? Well, the World Cup group draw will take place later today from 5 p.m. GMT. Groups A to L will be drawn live at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. FIFA President Gianni Infantino and many football managers are expected to be there. And you were talking this morning on the program about politics getting an invitation to the Eurovision Song Contest. Well, major sports events frequently also become platforms for political statements, diplomacy, and this World Cup is obviously no exception at all to the rule. This afternoon, the US President Donald Trump will attend the ceremony in Washington, which might be a little bit of a distraction from the draw, maybe. And speaking of diplomacy, the Iranian Football Federation has changed its mind as well about boycotting this draw. They have now sent at least two people to Washington this afternoon after four were granted visas. Earlier in the week, it was announced that no one would be representing Iran after five people, including the head of the Iranian Football Federation, had been denied visas. Well, they are now going. And staying with the World Cup, well, England manager Thomas Tuchel says he may have his substitutes stay in the dressing room during the matches at this World Cup next summer because of the risks of extreme heat and high temperatures. Let's hear what he has to say.
Well, it's an issue. It's an issue for high-level football. It will reduce the intensity of the matches. It will just reduce the amount of intensive runs offensively and defensively. And the match and the plan will naturally adapt. You cannot play the same football in 45 degrees than in 21 degrees. It's just as easy as that. And
that was England manager Thomas Tuchel. And a quick reminder of the scale of that World Cup. The competition will take place in 16 stadiums across the US, Canada and Mexico. 104 games in 39 days, spanning four time zones. That's all your sport this morning. For more and to follow this World Cup draw from 5.30 GMT this afternoon, you can, of course, head to the BBC Sport website, bbc.com/sport.
Thanks for the sport, Sarah. And something about swimming here. Lewis Pugh is a renowned endurance swimmer, and he's on a mission, which, if it all goes according to plan, he has started about an hour ago, because Lewis aims to climb Mount Kenya and the swim in its glaciers. He's doing this to raise awareness that the glaciers are vanishing rapidly. Scientists who analyze satellite imagery estimate that the planet has lost more than 28 trillion tons of ice in just 3 decades due to climate change. Before he started his expedition, I asked Lewis how he was feeling.
I'm really excited, but also nervous. You know, in 2010, I went up onto Mount Everest to do a swim. to highlight what was happening with the glaciers in the Himalayas. And when you do a swim at altitude, it's really challenging because right. if you swim too fast, you just can't breathe. But if you go too slow, you get hypothermia. And I remember diving into that lake on Mount Everest, and within about 30 seconds, I could barely breathe. I was gasping for air, and then I just couldn't move my arms and legs.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. It. Swimming at altitude is a real challenge.
So what happened on Mount Everest? Yeah. Were you rescued?
No. So I got to the edge of the lake. My team took me out. And then a few days later, this was really interesting. So normally when I swim in cold water, I swim fast, aggressive crawl. But the leader of the expedition, he said to me, Lewis, you cannot do this here on Mount Everest. You need to change. He said, instead of swimming crawl, swim breaststroke. Then you can breathe whenever you want to. And he also said, instead of swimming fast, swim slow. And then lastly, he gave me some other piece of advice. He said, swim with humility. He said, you can't bully Mount Everest. And so
How
a few days later,
that?
I went up there and I did the swim slow breaststroke with humility and I made it.
Mount Kenya is nowhere near the height of Mount Everest. But are there unique challenges you expect from this swim?
So I think the swim on Mount Kenya is actually going to be pretty similar to the swim which I did on Mount Everest in 2010.
How so?
I mean, the height difference is quite similar. So the swim on Mount Kenya is going to be at 4,700 meters. The swim which I did on Mount Everest in the Khumbu Glacier, that was at 5,200. So fairly similar heights. And as I mentioned, when you swim at altitude, what makes it so challenging is that when you swim fast, and that's the way I try to swim when I'm in cold water, when you swim fast, you can't breathe. There's just not enough oxygen. But when you swim slowly, then the problem is you start getting really, really cold. And so you've got to get that balance right. And I have done nearly 20 years of swimming in front of glaciers, and I've only ever done one high altitude swim. So this will be my second one. The preparation has been twofold. In order to prepare for the swimming, I've been swimming in the sea off Plymouth now. It's really nippy here in winter. I've been swimming and just sprinting a kilometer in the sea. And then in order to prepare for the altitude training, what I've been doing is a local university here, Plymouth Marjon University, has got an altitude chamber. And so I go into that altitude chamber and they can take me up to 4,000 meters. And then they put me on a treadmill and now I have to run. And I start off by just walking for 3 minutes and then running for 3 minutes, walking for 3 minutes, running for 3 minutes. And then they make it faster and faster and faster until my legs are burning and I'm gasping for air. And that's the best preparation you can do for altitude, to get yourself ready.
Why do you do this?
The aim of the swim is to highlight what is happening to the glaciers in East Africa. We are losing ice rapidly, and the glaciers in Africa are disappearing faster than almost anywhere else in the world. The glaciers on Mount Kenya, they're expected to disappear in the next 3 to 5 years. I had no idea. I was shocked. I thought they had decades. No, they don't. Ice is essential for life on Earth. Ice keeps our planet cool. It keeps us within a temperature range in which we can all live. You know, ice provides us with water. It's our most precious resource. And the science is so stark. At 1.5 degrees of warming, we're expected to lose nearly half of the world's glacial ice. And at 2.7 degrees of warming, we're expected to lose nearly three quarters of the world's glacial ice. I mean, so every single fraction of a degree of warming now matters. So I'm going to be climbing up Mount Kenya and I'm going to be going to the Lewis Glacier. Now that's the main glacier on the mountain. And so I'm going to be going up there. There's a small lake beneath the glacier at 4,700 meters above sea level. I'm going to get into this lake and do a symbolic swim. And the aim of the swim is very, very simple, to highlight just how important ice is for all of us. You know, sadly, it's no longer possible to save the Lewis Glacier. So I will be swimming beneath a dying glacier. But hopefully, we can influence how much glacial ice is saved in other parts of the world.
Lewis Pugh should be climbing the mountain as we speak. That's it from this edition of Newsday from the BBC. With me, Anne Soy in Nairobi.
I'm Rob Young in London. Have a good weekend. Thanks for listening.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
It's Michelle Martin. Every weekday morning, my Morning Edition co-host and I have some questions.
What do you say to that concern from voters that they're...
Can this squarely be laid on the feet of the government shutdown, or are there deeper problems?
Do you agree it's important for government officials to be truthful before Congress?
Get information, context, accountability on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI 89.3 North Highland Sacramento, and live online.